it wasn't necessarily truth that he defined as we defined it, but he more or less chased after facts. And he said that there are two ways that we go after facts, if you will. He says we go by facts by example, and then the other one is through saying. So we use language in terms of expressing examples, and we use language to express or to go after facts by sayings. So example, let's see how he described examples. He said examples, you had two ways of using examples. One is relating things that have happened before. Relating things that happened before. What do we call that? Relating things that happened before. What we call happened before? If you were in school, what subject would that be?
History.
History, right? Exactly. So we use example of history. We go to something that happened in history and we try to use that to prove a point. But then he says there's another example too. And he says we can invent them ourselves, right? So when you're looking at different type of writing, you have the writing that you call what? If you're not looking in reality, you're looking at what?
Fiction,
right? Right, fiction, excuse my writing. But yeah, fiction, right? So he says that you can use history or you can use fiction, you can make it yourself. So you can use something that actually occurred, so that's truth, right? Because if it happens, then you got evidence and everything else to show that it happened. But then you can also use something that's called fiction as well, right? And he said there's actually two forms of fiction. There's a fiction called fable. A fable is an impossible and unrealistic thing that can occur, that you can say verbally that has occurred, right? So a fable is impossible or unrealistic. But then there's this thing called comparison. Comparison is where it's possible and it's realistic fiction. Y'all hear the contrast or here's the tension in that? It's possible and it's realistic fiction, meaning that it's not necessarily a true story, but it's possible, right? Right, it's possible and it's realistic, but yet it's still fiction. Are y'all following me? Because that's a big and distinct difference between the parable that we're going to talk about. Because the parable we're talking about is something that points to what? Truth. They're going to point to truth. These parables point to truth. To truth. Not necessarily to facts or what Aristotle was saying, but it's going to point to truth. So, an example of history is Abraham Lincoln's assassination. We can go back in time and we can check out all the facts and newspaper articles and everything else and gather all that information up and boom, we can prove that it occurred, right? We can see that it occurred. Another example is that if you don't believe that 296 exists, you can just drive here and see it, right? You can actually see it. But then there's, like I said, fiction. Fiction is something that you end up making it yourself. You know, like the only thing that comes to mind right now is how, you know, folks that joke and say, no, they didn't testify, but they test a
lie.
Right, test a lie, right? So it's a fiction. It doesn't come up and it's not true. It didn't really exist, right? So he says examples. He says you have examples. Then to move on, just to save time, he says you also have sayings. Sayings. He was very technical in what he was saying, in what he was describing. He said, not only do you have examples, but then you also have sayings. And under sayings, you got two things under sayings. Just, you got maxims. I'll spell that for you all so you guys can look it up after class. M-A-X-I-M. Right? You got maxims, right? A maxim is a rule for good or sensible behavior. A rule for good or sensible behavior. He broke that down, and I give you an example of a maxim, right? A maxim is like this, and you've heard it before. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's a maxim. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But then he says there are other types of sayings as well, and those sayings are proverbs. A proverb is a short, pithy, meaning really full of meaning, story or statement about human nature and life, right? It's a short, pithy statement about human nature and life. Give you an example of that. There's an old saying that says, if you scratch a liar, you find a thief. Y'all ever heard of that saying? Scratch a liar, find a thief. Basically what that means is that if you find a liar, then you're gonna find somebody that'll steal from you too. That's what it meant. And that's going way back in the day. Or I'll give you a good one that Elder Williamson used to say. A hit dog was sure enough holler. Right? That means if you're guilty, you'll end up telling on yourself. Right? A hit dog sure enough holler. But now, leaving Aristotle and leaving that extra biblical stuff, now all of a sudden we're going to go into what we think a parable is. We're not going to go into a maxim, and we're not going to go into a proverb as he defines it, and neither are we going to go into defining facts or being on a fact-chasing hunt like him. We're going to try to understand what a parable means and what it reveals. What a parable means and what it reveals. So, who can give me an example of what a parable means? Just take it out. I got a definition, but let's see how close we can come to it before I give that definition. Who can tell me what it means? That's for class participation. What you think it means? No wrong answers at this point. The only time there's a wrong answer is after I give you the right one. Exactly. Yeah. I remember that definition. Yeah. Exactly. Anybody else want to add to that? If you didn't hear, sister out in Zoom land, she said it was an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Anybody else want to take a stab at it? Just in case you don't know how to spell parable, I'll do that too. P-A-R-A-B-L-E. All right. Okay, I will. So, parable. Parable, the definition I found was this: a short, simple story designed to communicate a spiritual truth, religious principle, or moral lesson, a figure of speech in which truth is illustrated by a comparison or example drawn from everyday experience. And I'll say that again, parable, a short, simple story designed to communicate a spiritual truth, religious principle, or moral lesson, a figure of speech in which truth is illustrated by a comparison or example drawn from everyday experience. All right? It's an extended metaphor. It's a a metaphor or a simile. If you guys don't know what metaphor and simile means, then metaphor is basically saying he is a mouse. That's an example of a metaphor. He is a mouse. Simile is he is like a mouse. The only difference is that word like, right? So a metaphor is he is a mouse. Simile is he is like a mouse. Both are using comparisons, right? They're both using comparisons to try to get you to understand what a person or what someone is like, right? So they're both using comparisons, but they just use it a bit different. Where one is saying that he is a mouse, right? The other one is saying he is like a mouse, right? So the word parable in Greek literally means saying by the side of, or casting along, or a comparison, or a likeness. So Jesus was using stories, if you will. He was an awesome storyteller to give you a likeness of something in mind so that you can keep in mind. And then all of a sudden what he meant, what he really meant was going to come later on. So it had a double meaning, so to speak. And it also had a double purpose. Parables had a double purpose, right? Whereas for believers, it had a purpose, but for unbelievers, it had a purpose as well. So the same story had two different purposes, if you will. Can anyone guess what it was for believers? What do you think the purpose was for believers? What would a parable do for believers? If you recall, in Matthew, the 13th chapter, Jesus had made a decision. He said, that, as a matter of fact, Matthew has about 7 parables in it. Matthew, the 13th chapter, has about 7 parables in it. But Jesus made a decision. He said, I'm going to speak in parables from this time on, right? And he said, I'm going to speak in parables because for those that believe, he wanted them to do what? To perceive, right? He wanted to enlighten them. But for those who did not believe,
they would see and not see.
They won't, yeah, exactly. They would, it would be right in front of them, and they still wouldn't get it. So parables had a way of enlightening and blinding. You see what I'm saying? It had a way of enlightening. For those who believe, you can say, oh, that's what he was getting at. I see. But for those who didn't believe, they would still go away saying, huh? I don't get it.
It's not about intellect.
And it wasn't about intellect. That's great. It wasn't about intellect, because now we're starting to get into this area of spiritual truth, right? Let me tell you one other thing before we get into the parable. Parables weren't new. They weren't new. They were not new. If somebody please will read for me 2 Samuel 12. Verses 1 through 4. Parables weren't new. We got them in the Old Testament. In 2 Samuel 12, 1 through 4, it was a famous parable that someone gave. His name was Nathan. And if you can read those first 4 verses, what did it say? It's 12, 1 through 4.
Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to them and said, there were 2 men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished. And I grew up together with him and his children. He would eat up of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.
Yeah. And he wasn't talking about a lamb. He was talking about who?
Bathsheba.
Bathsheba, right? Right. And he wasn't talking about just a man in general. He was talking about who? Right. And he was also talking about another man. Who was that? Uriah, right? So he was using this parable to bring home what? A truth, right? And he wanted to enlighten David that God, what? Basically, he was saying, thou art the man. That was it. And it made David do what?
Get angry, he burned with grief.
He was mad. He was like, oh my goodness. When he didn't understand the point, he got really, really angry, right? And he said, where is he? You know, where is he? But then all of a sudden, when he understood who it was talking about, he then did what? He repented, right? He repented. So parables weren't new, right? They weren't new. So we've understood, now we've gone over, just to briefly review, we've gone over like how the world looks at language and what language would prove or what it should prove by examples and sayings and things of that nature. Not to say that Aristotle did not do some great contributions to how we understand language. That's not the point. The point is that they weren't after truth like we are after a truth, right? They wanted truth, but not in that spiritual sense that we are after truth. And we're after truth in that spiritual sense. So that, just like I said, I just wanted to try to give an example, and also I want to just try to just to review it, just in case somebody, I lost somebody on the way. So now we're going to get into it where we understand what a parable is. We understand that it's a short story, right? And it's directed to revealing the truth. He's using everyday things to get at a spiritual truth. And it also has a meaning to enlighten believers, but also to confuse and blind, right? Those who don't believe, right? So that's what it is. Now let's get into the parable, and it's two short parables. If you can turn to Matthew, the 13th chapter, verse 44 through 46. Two short parables that we're going to just go over tonight. Amen. Two short parables. And I want you guys to walk along with me here and see what these parables are talking about. I'm going to read the first one for you. The first one is called the parable of the hidden treasure. The parable of the hidden treasure. It says, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again. And from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. I'm going to read that one more time. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again. And from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Now we are going to break this down, and I want you all to take this adventure with me And I want you to be invested in this process of understanding what Jesus was saying. What was he saying? And let me give you a huge tip. All right, here's a huge tip when you're dealing with parables. Don't try to go so deep right off the bat. Don't try to go so deep right off the bat. You know, ooh, the, what does the mean? See, the T, you notice that it start with a T and treasure start with a T? Don't go there yet. The best way to approach a parable is to just go ahead and literally get the understanding first. Let's first get the understanding as the everyday story that Jesus was presenting, right? The everyday story that he was presenting. So we can see right off the bat that Jesus is presenting a comparison, because he says, the kingdom of heaven is like, right? The kingdom of heaven is like. Let's just for a moment, let's define kingdom of heaven. Kingdom of heaven. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Kingdom of heaven. What do you think that is? I didn't hear you. I'm sorry. One more time. This kingdom of heaven, that expression, what do you think it means? Kingdom of heaven. You said where God is? Yep. That's true, and that's a start, but I need a little more. Where God is, anybody else want to finish it? We know that we live on what?
Earth.
We live on the earth, right? All right? And then in the earth, we know that there are different countries, and back in the day, they used to call them what? Kingdoms, right? Kingdoms. So are we talking about that type of kingdom? Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about a spiritual truth for a moment, because Jesus is flat out saying the kingdom of heaven, right? The kingdom of heaven is light. So the kingdom of heaven, what do you think that is if we're talking about Jesus saying kingdom of heaven? It's got to be a spiritual thing, right? It's got to be a spiritual thing.
There's a chat, a comment in the chat that says the place where God is king.
Place where God is king. Place where God is king. Now, we know that God rules over everything, right? He does. He's in control of everything. But for this place and time, from Jesus' first coming to his second coming, does he rule like he's going to rule? No. So right now we're talking about ruling where? Right?
Right there.
Right here, right in the heart, so to speak. So in a real sense, the kingdom of heaven is where? It's in the heart, right? But he's also saying his kingdom for right now, because we got to go back. See where we're starting in the 13th chapter of Matthew's? We can't ignore those verses that came ahead of this. We got to remember that the disciples were confused at this time. Jesus started off with the parables of the wheat and tare and I forgot the other one. The other one is not coming to mind now. Say it again. The seed, yeah. The soil, yeah. So he was talking about those. And honestly, at this time, the disciples were like, huh? Okay, they end up coming to him and saying, can you please break this down for us? So here is it in summation. What Jesus was saying is, right now, the kingdom of heaven, think of it like this, as John MacArthur says. Think of it like this. It's where God is in control. But for right now, there are believers and non-believers, unbelievers, that are existing. But not only are they existing, but they are also existing together, right? Because one day he's going to come and he's going to separate the two. But for now, they're coming and they're growing together, right? The wheat and the tear, they're growing together. So for now, this is what the kingdom consists of. But that real true kingdom is right here, right? It's in the heart. Those who place him as Lord and King now. So he's trying to say, I'm going to get real personal with you. I'm not going to go global with you right now. I'm going to get personal with you. So in this parable, I was talking about global stuff, but now I'm going to get personal with you. These two parables are personal parables, right? This one of hidden treasure is personal now. So he's saying the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure. What does treasure mean? Don't get spiritual on treasure right now. What does treasure mean? Something of great value. Something of great value, right? And he says that the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure, something of great value. And what did the person do with it? He hid it. It's like it's hidden in a field. It's hidden in a field. Now, I want you to imagine, here's a brother in the field, right? And it says, which a man found. So he had to what? Right? He dug it up, right? And then all of a sudden he found it. And what did he do?
He hid it again.
Mm-hmm. But he found it. Mm-hmm. He found it. Mm-hmm. But then he go and he hide it again.
It didn't belong to him.
Ooh. Ooh. See, some folks say, what a moral dilemma here. It's a moral dilemma that's going on here. Mm-hmm. The dude finds it, but then he hides it. He hides it again, and he didn't just chill. What did he do? He got happy about the fact that he found it, right? So from joy over it, he goes and he does what?
Sells everything he has.
He sells everything he has.
To buy the field.
Okay, let's think this out now. He sells everything he has to buy the field. I can think of a few scenarios, right? If I find the money, I think I'm gonna operate a bit different, right? But before I even go there, let me explain something to you all. The common law back then for Jewish people, it was finders, keepers, losers, weepers. Okay? If you found it, you owned it. So there was no ethical issue here. He was in the right he owned it. He found it, right? But here's the other thing. The brother was digging in a field, and it gives you the mindset that it wasn't his field, right? So if it wasn't his field, then more than likely what? It's the owner of the field, right? But check it out. Was the treasurer the owner of the field? You would think, right? You would think, right? Let me give you another scenario. Back in those days, you did not have PNC care. You didn't have PNC. You had homes that were made of clay. mainly clay and other like earthly substance, right? And they were easy to break into. If you were a thief, it was easy to break into. All you had to do is claw your way through and go, and you can get whatever was valuable to people. So what people did is that they went into a field and they found a spot, and they did what? They buried it, right? They buried it, right? So they buried it. So in this scenario, what most theologians say is that this man was doing the honorable thing, because by law, by Jewish law, finders keepers, losers weepers. Here's another thing. If he was digging in a field and he finds it and he acts the way he was acting, it wasn't his treasure. He didn't put it there. But more than likely, the person that owned the field at that time, due to the fact that it was war and everything else going on, more than likely, the person that owned it didn't know it was there either, right?
Or else he
would have sold it. Or else, thank you. Thank you, you stole my thunder. Or else he would have
dug it up first.
Thank you, he would have dug it up first, right? He would have dug it up first. And then say, yeah, I'll sell it to you, brother, right? So he wasn't the owner, and neither the present owner, more than likely, wasn't the owner. So there had to be a third owner that more than likely, because times were so violent during that time, he may have been dead at that time. All right? It's safe to say that he may have died. So this brother, he was doing the right thing. So what did he do? He what? He buried again, and he said, all right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go, and I'm going to like purchase the land, right? See, with me, in the way I think, in my mind think, my thought is this. I find that treasure, right? I get a little bit of it, right? And I get a little bit of it, and I go, and I purchase it, right? Or better yet, I get it all. And I look to my left, and I look to my right, and I can keep on pushing, right? But he was doing, in other words, what I'm trying to tell you, even though it's not the main point of the parable, the point is that this brother was doing the right thing, okay? That's why I wanted to belabor that point a bit. He was doing the right thing. But this is interesting. What he did is he hid it, and then from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. So literally, what is he doing now? What did he do? He buried it, and he wants this treasure, right? He wants it. So he's trying to get it, and he's trying to get it legitimately, right? And what he does, he goes and what? What it says here? Yep, he sells all he has and he comes back and buys the field. So what do we think this means? Let's try to put a spiritual meaning to that. What do you think it means? Anybody?
It kind of suggests to me that the value of the treasure far outweighed all of his possessions. And he was willing to give up all of his possessions just for that one treasure. It also kind of points to the idea that after finding the treasure, he wanted to do the right thing. It made him do the right thing, which is to take everything that he had and then actually buy it in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
If the person was dead, he could have had squatter's rights. He could have just possessed it, but he wanted to do the right thing.
Right.
And, it sounds to me like he was willing to give up everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that his heart had also been changed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was demonstrated because he didn't want to set up treasure in the wrong place, but he set his treasure up in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where his heart was at. as well. And Jesus kind of spoke to that same thing in terms of where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So it was like his whole heart was in that, and it was worth enough for him to just go ahead and take every earthly possession he had and count it as dung, and basically say this is worthless compared to this one treasure.
That's right. And let me expound on something that you said, where his heart was right. Because we said that once it comes to the real kingdom of heaven, where is it at? It's in the heart, right? And we said that in right now, this kingdom is made up of what? Believers and non-believers. The believers, they have it in their heart, right? But in order to go to heaven one day, what do you need to be down here? Maybe I said that too. You need to be a citizen of heaven, right? And in order to be a citizen of the kingdom, who do you need to have received? Jesus, right? And that's right. So we need to be saved, right? So we're talking about salvation. We're talking about salvation. So if salvation is the treasure, right? It's saying that if salvation is the treasure, then salvation is so greatly, greatly valued that we would do what? We would give up everything. We would give up everything we have to obtain.
Bishop Washington, he would say that I'm sold out.
Yes.
Exactly. And the fact that the treasure was Jesus Christ on the premise of somebody telling him about it. And so he believed the word of God and mm-hmm. realized his state, his spiritual state, knowing that the way he was living was worthless. Mm-hmm. And the new life that he was being offered, this is what he wanted. And he gave up everything. I mean,
Exactly. That's what it's saying. Salvation is so precious.
Mm-hmm.
Salvation is so precious that we will give up everything. It's worth giving up all this down here, right? It's worth giving up what we consider valuable down here. Right? To be with Jesus, right? To be with Jesus. And that's what it's saying. It's like, I need to get personal with you all, Jesus was saying. This is this salvation that I'm talking about. This is this kingdom of heaven that I'm talking about. The kingdom of heaven that I'm talking about is within, but it's so precious. It's so precious to you that you've given up, right, to obtain. You've given up things to obtain it. Now, some people say, and here's another brother interpretation of it. No way does it mean that, because then it brings in this ideal of people can work for their salvation. So the man who was digging and everything was really Jesus. See, and that's when you read all these theologians, they can come up with different ideas. And this person said, no, the person that Jesus was referring to is himself. And he went out and he gave up everything on the cross to get the treasure of us, the church. Can y'all see it though?
Yeah.
You can't see it, right? You can see it. Right? However, that's why you got to go to the previous verses, right? You got to go to the previous verses. And these parables keep a theme, right? They keep a theme, and they're talking about saved and unsaved, right? They're talking about, and then Jesus goes to where he's making this thing personal, And like I told you all, these parables are making it personal, right? They're making it personal. And let's read the other one real quick because we're running out of time here. It says, a costly pearl. Now, what's the takeaway for the hidden treasure? What's the takeaway with that? What did we take away from that? What's our meaning there?
Salvation is of so much value that you're willing to give up
everything. Right? Let's see what about this costly pearl right quick. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Right? That's what he's saying. This is not a repeat of the story with just different characters. This is another point that he's trying to make here. So quickly, the kingdom of heaven is the same kingdom that we're still talking about. We're seeing that he's making a comparison. It is like, right? But then he says, a merchant seeking fine pearls. Real quick, because of time, I can tell you this. There were merchants, like investors, like business owners and everything else, that dealt with pearls. Pearls were very valuable back in those days, right? Matter of fact, they were valuable because people had to do some crazy things to just get a pearl. Like, for example, they didn't have scuba gear or anything like that back in those days. So what they would do is they would get a rock, tie that rock by a rope, and then all of a sudden they would throw the rock over the boat, and then the boat, and then they jumped off the boat, and then that rock would take them way down there, right? They risked their lives because they had sea monsters down there. See, they didn't name a shark and all that stuff back then. They didn't have all of this technical stuff that we have. So they had to fight the sea monsters and everything else when they went down there. And plus, the more you went down, what did it do? It messed with your lungs. So it was a life-threatening thing that they did, and they just toss that rock over, go down, and then they start digging around in the mud and everything else, trying to find pearls. And they would come up with the pearl, and one pearl would set you straight. You would be all right with pearls. Caligula, the emperor, his wife had, like they said, she had pearls on her head, she had pearls on her ears, she had pearls on her neck, she had pearls on her finger, and they said, estimated, she probably had $36 million worth of pearl back in those days. So it was a sign of wealth and everything else. And everybody was looking for the pearl, right? Jesus even gave it an example of how valuable pearls were as well when he said, don't cast your pearls. Right, so it was a valuable thing. So they go around. So what he says is that this merchant was seeking a pearl. He had pearls, but what he did, in the 46th verse, and upon finding one pearl of great value. So he had pearls, but he was doing what? He was looking for more, right? Right, he was looking for more. So he had things that folks would value, right? He had things that folks would value, but he was looking for more. He wasn't satisfied with those things that people value. So he went looking for more, right? He was looking for more. And then when he ends up looking and he finds it, and he finds it of great value, what did he do? He sold all the other ones to obtain that one what? That one pearl of great value, right? Of great value. So what does that mean then? Let's see if we can understand what it means. What do y'all think it means? Take a stab at the spiritual meaning of this.
Kind of reminds me of the verse that says you can gain the whole wide world, but what is it if you lose your soul? So like, you know, he had things, you know, that may be a value of this world, but being to get salvation or, you know, finding Jesus is worth way more.
That's a good stab. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Who else can put it in another way? But that's it.
A lot of times, especially people that have everything, people like celebrities and things, they have what we might look at as everything that you want, but yet their lives are not fulfilled. There's a void. They're searching for something. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was looking for.
Find that something with your salvation. They're willing to give up their lifestyle.
And that's exactly what I'm looking for. Yeah. That's the peace I was looking for. That's the peace I was looking for. So all these things down here that folks value, right?
They don't satisfy.
They don't satisfy. Mm-hmm. They don't satisfy. You keep looking and you keep searching. You keep searching, and you can have it all, but you still feel empty, right? It's like what Dr. David Jeremiah said. He said, God created us, but he created us with a little hole in our heart, right? And that little hole in our heart is reserved only for him. No matter what you try to put in it, it ain't gonna fit, right? It's only for him. So we can go and we can and get the best car, the best house, best clothes, and everything else. But the truth is that it won't satisfy. It's just like the woman at the well, right? That water she keeps drinking, but it only temporarily does something, right? But then Jesus said, I offer you what?
Living water.
Living water, right? And it also tells us in a spiritual sense that all of us go through journeys in life, don't we? We all try stuff, right? Y'all may not have tried the same thing I've tried, right? I may have tried this and that. You probably tried that and this, right? Yes, and you probably tried to get yourself and quench your thirst in a different way than me, than I have. However, what it's saying, though, is that we may have tried those paths, but the truth is that we kept looking and we just knew that it was something more valuable. There was something more valuable. And all of a sudden, when we found Jesus, we said what? Eureka. Right? Right? I found him. I found him. And you know what? He is so valuable. I'm willing to give up all those other little pearls to get this great pearl of salvation. So what is this? What's the takeaway in this one? Matter of fact, review. What was the takeaway in the hidden treasure? What was the takeaway of the hidden treasure once again? Can y'all remember? Y'all forgot that quick. What is it?
Salvation was of so much value that you were willing to sell everything you had.
Yep, salvation is, yep, it's so valuable. So what's the point of the hidden pearl?
Doesn't matter what you have, there's always a void unless it's filled by God.
Case closed. We're done. We're done. And those are that's the parable of the hidden treasure and the parable of the pearl. So we got about 2 minutes to take questions, or if somebody don't understand, or comments. I know that I kind of hogged the time there. Any comments or questions?
There isn't the parable of the pearl talking about, you know, and a lot of relationships,
mm-hmm.
people have that same problem because one or the other make is looking for satisfaction, looking for their life to be fulfilled by the other make.
Yeah.
When the make is not a problem.
Right.
It's that void.
Yeah.
Same thing.
That's it. That's it. Yeah.
One more thing. One more thing. It could be a person that don't have anything, nothing. And then all of a sudden, someone come and tell them about who Jesus is.
That's true.
And
that's
because true. Of their heart is so ready for to be, the heart is so fertile after the witness and everything. They said, wow, that's right. Jesus can help me.
That's it.
And, yeah. Jesus can help me. And he is the reason for every last bit of that. That's the treasure. That's the pearl right there. It's Jesus, man.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's true. And we, like I said, we take different paths, right? We got to this point of knowing that Christ is all. We may have come from different paths in life, but we all understand now, if you're a believer, you understand that Christ is all. Amen. Amen. And that is it. God bless you all. We're going to stand.